From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. This is going to be an interesting episode today.
Yeah.
So I want to go ahead and congratulate everyone who did not judge today's episode by the title alone. I think the title of this is actually The Surprisingly Unboring Story of Farm Subsidies.
Yeah, it could be interpreted as a snooze fest, but you know us, you know this show. There is not a snooze fest amongst it.
It reminds me of that part in Wayne's World where he's doing the green screen and he's like, hey, I'm in Delaware. Because Delaware seems like the most boring place, but as it turns out, it's an incredible tax haven.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
Secret excitement all around.
That's why all of your credit cards and many of your banks are based, for some reason, in Delaware.
Dover, I believe.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yep, because the laws are different. Now, this topic was not something that the three or four of us came up with on our own. Like many of the best suggestions for this show, this came to us from a listener email from The Raven with a Y. Now, The Raven, maybe I can remove the definitive there and just call you Raven. You sent us this fantastic email. It's a little bit long, so we're just going to read some excerpts, but we're going to set it up. And I got to say, my friend, I like the way you write.
Oh, for sure. Especially adding in your own sound effects.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
Oh, yeah.
Raven says, greetings, gentlemen. I bring you information for a possible episode. The topic may seem boring on the surface, but I feel as though something is amiss. I present to you Farm Subsidies.
Submitted for your approval.
Dun, 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 dun. Yes, my friends, farm subsidies. I don't know much about it, but I noticed odd things with a specific company, so there may be other things out there.
Here are the facts. First off, there's no such thing as a dumb question, so what the hell is a farm subsidy? Farm subsidies are essentially cash given from a government, the U.S. does this as well as many other countries, to support agribusinesses. These can be absolute lifesavers because being a farmer is difficult. And it's a dicey proposition. Farmers can use the money provided by the government to ride out risk and the potentially enormous losses involved in this unpredictable industry. Like, you can't predict the weather all the time. You can't predict how you're going to interact with commodities brokers. You can't predict demand as accurately as people would want. Farm subsidies are a thing that is pretty close to Mission Control's heart. And we did check to make sure it's okay that we said that, but we always like to lean on people with personal experience. We like primary sources. So if you hear us pausing when we say something and then quickly correcting ourselves, it may be because Paul gave us the glare of death through the studio window.
And look, this is a little known here. This has never happened before. Paul's mic, Mission Control's mic, is live right now. So, like, if he wanted to, he could say a word. But he's not going to.
I'm feeling a sense of foreboding when he said that. That was very
so exciting.
He's like this cartoon rabbit. So it's like, if you don't have something nice to say, don't say nothing at all. So Paul is going to chime in if he has something nice, a.k.a. helpful, to say.
Yeah, correct. Yes. Farm subsidies, though. You may have heard them tossed around in a lot of headlines recently. You're going to read language like farm bailout.
Yes, right? That's the one that I've seen the most.
So these things have a long, long history here in the U.S. The Homestead Act in 1862 granted land in the West to anyone willing to farm it. Said, just show up, make food, and you can have the land it grows on. And then in the same year, there was something called the Morrill Act, M-O-R-R-I-L-L, that was passed. This funded colleges of agriculture. So Uncle Sam always knew that food was important, and the government intervened multiple times throughout this country's history to assist in the creation of farming interests, like the Federal Farm Loan Act, that would give you pretty generous loans if and only if you were a farmer or starting a farm.
Yeah, it's one of those things as humans, we need water, we need to be able to breathe, we need shelter, we need love, and we need food. Food is very important. And food production becomes very, very important, especially when you're in a time of crisis, like of war, let's say. That's why this the subsidizing or the assistance with farming is so essential, because each of us has to eat. So let's jump to 1929.
Let's do it. 1929, in which the Agricultural Marketing Act of 1929, it established the Federal Farm Board, which sought to keep crop prices manageable, keep them from absolutely bottoming out. So farmers were – the hope was that they would limit crops, but that – didn't really take. And then the Bureau bought and stockpiled these crops in order to, you know, kind of manipulate supply and demand by limiting supply. And then it kind of switched gears and transformed into the Farm Credit Administration in 1933.
And then in 1933, Congress signs what's called the Agricultural Adjustment Act, or AAA. Again, I know we can get in the weeds here, but this stuff, this will be important later. When we get to the weird part of this, we'll all be glad that we know this now.
Yes.
So this AAA, Agricultural Adjustment Act, did something very similar to what you were talking about in 1929, Noel. It reduced crop output. It paid farmers to not do their job.
And you think, why on earth would you do that? Don't we need more food? Isn't this whole thing about all of us needing to eat?
Right. But you also want people to make a living, because if everybody is growing a ton of – this is an example Paul used. If everybody has a bumper crop and grows a great amount of wheat, then how are they going to be able to sell it? Because the price will plummet. And then you as a farmer are being punished for doing well.
So, yeah, you're right. It really is about supply and demand.
Mm-hmm. And this AAA, this had some extreme results. Crop prices in general doubled within just 4 years, and the Supreme Court overturned the AAA because it was putting taxes on people who processed crops, but it was giving money to farmers. And then they tried to fix it again in 1938. And then when a lot of farms were being foreclosed upon, the Emergency Farm Mortgage Act was a government intervention that gave farms the life-saving loans they needed to continue their businesses.
So in the same year, in 1938, we've got the new Agricultural Adjustment Act, creatively named because it was like the new one. Mm-hmm. And that kind of took care of some of the issues that were presented by the 1933 version. And this price support system, as it was referred to, kind of petered out in the 1990s.
But it lasted for a long time.
Well, exactly. Yeah, but that's sort of when it had run its course. And the federal government was able to, pretty astoundingly, guarantee farmers a high enough price to stay in business, to actually make a profit for their families. How was this accomplished? Well, it paid farmers to make sure – again, manipulating supply and demand, make sure the supply did not exceed the demand. Then the government subsidized farmers to keep crop lands idle, so fallow fields essentially, in order to prevent basically waste, crop waste, overproduction. It also actually bought out any excess crops. It then either stockpiled them or gave them away to lower income families throughout the world. So it had kind of a philanthropic wing to it as well. And then in 1999, farm subsidies. It's kind of the year for peak farm subsidies when it reached a record $22 billion.
Right.
Can I bring something up here that we
– Please.
That happened in the 1980s, I think 1985. Mm. It's something that Paul was talking to us about earlier off mic called the Conservation Reserve Program. Can we talk about that now?
Yeah, just the quickly? Fallow fields. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, because we kind of just mentioned it there. It's called the Conservation Reserve Program, or CRP, and I'm reading this from the fsa.usda.gov. This is a program that – in exchange for a yearly rental payment, farmers enrolled in this program agree to remove environmentally sensitive land from agricultural production and plant species that will improve the environmental health and quality. So it's these contracts – not a contract, I guess. It's you sign up for this program, then portions of your farmland are just kind of let to go wild basically.
Which allows the soil to regenerate. It's probably better for local wildlife, you know, especially herbivores amongst the fauna. Then we can see the logic here, even though it sounds maybe a little Joseph Heller-esque at first, like, what, you're paying me not to do something?
Yeah.
But it feels, and many people argue, that it is necessary. Of course, not anybody who has ever tried to buy like a dragon fruit or a pomegranate quickly learns – or avocados, for God's sake, quickly learns that not all crops are subsidized. Here in the U.S., out of all of the crops that farmers grow, there are only 5 that are subsidized: corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, and rice. And that's because the grains here in this list are the big, big players. If you just took the edible stuff from what we named, rice, wheat, soybeans, corn, and you added up all of those crops, and then you looked at how much food all the people on Earth collectively ate, 80% of it would be rice, wheat, soybeans, and corn.
Think about food processing and how many products exist in grocery stores across the world that are based in one of those, or if not multiples.
Well, not only stuff in grocery stores. Think about ethanol that comes from corn. And I don't want to jump the gun. I'm sure we're going to get into this a little more later, but I believe some of those subsidies went away under the Trump administration. So a lot of farmers are having trouble now because they grew excess corn that they could then sell, you know, to be made into ethanol. Mm-hmm. And I think because of our move by this government to more like coal kind of based things and fossil fuels, those subsidies kind of were changed in a negative way that affected some of these farmers.
Well, yeah, and also across the world, we've talked about this before, Ben, these things that can be produced rather cheaply or, like, you know, somewhat cheaply in more rural places, it's like the reason why it represents that much of the caloric intake is because it's fairly cheap to do and you can make a lot of it and it can just be the staple in your diet.
It can be financially cheap, but for those people who are growing these crops in developing countries, it's incredibly time intensive, right?
Oh, yes,
exactly. So you're paying with time.
Exactly. And I don't mean to downplay what it takes to have a functioning rice paddy or something. I just mean overall, if you think about all of the crops that are out there, the things you could be planting, that's why these make up that much of the caloric intake.
And that's a huge, important point. It's only going to become more profound as we continue. If we look at the states overall, the states and all the U.S. territories, we'll see that there are some clear front runners in the farm subsidy industry. Make no mistake, it is an industry by itself. Those top 5 states are Texas, Nebraska, Kansas, shout out to Mission Control, Arkansas, and Illinois. In 2017, according to the EWG Farm Subsidy Database, these 5 states received 38.5% of the $7.2 billion distributed through these subsidy programs. Wow. Now, astute listeners, though, you'll notice that number is much smaller than the number we cited earlier. In 1999, farm subsidies were $22 billion, and now if we go to 2017, they're down to $7.2 billion. So we see a lot of waxing and waning here. It's not a consistent amount of funding.
And it is odd just with inflation and the way that goes overall that it would reduce by that much.
Right, right. Because, you know, we can explain that by saying, well, different times are changing, right? And some administrations have different aims than others.
Absolutely.
And, of course, it would be naive to say that some of the increases were not somehow pushed by special interest groups, right? That's just the reality. But what about other what about other crops? Because those five things aren't everything people grow. They're also peanuts, sorghum, and mohair. These things get smaller subsidies.
What is mohair?
What is sorghum?
Paul, what is mohair? All right. I've just never heard of it.
Mohair is the fabric.
That's what Benny and the Jets wear. Electric boots, a mohair suit. Mm. You know, I read it in a magazine.
Is it a grain?
I thought it was a fabric.
I know it is. It's a mohair. I'm not making this up.
Made from Angora goats.
Oh.
I used to think he was saying mole hair suit, which would be weird because aren't moles kind of suitless or like furless?
Yeah, they're suitless.
Yeah, that goes back to it is interesting because it's like cotton, right? You can't eat it. So why are we subsidizing it? I believe it goes back to maybe the 1950s. It's for goat and sheep producers.
Oh, okay.
Because they wanted to be able to have the ability to make cheap clothes.
Right? That's awesome.
Wool clothing and so on. But what about the other things we eat? Because unless you're vegan, you are eating other stuff, right? The stuff other than these grains. You're eating fruits, you're eating vegetables, and if you're an omnivore, you're eating meat. And I know there are several of us in the audience who are like, I'm as close to a carnivore as you can get. Well, if you're only eating meat, this still does affect you, because what do livestock eat? They eat grains. And the people who create the meat, fruit, and vegetables that you eat in your local grocery store or restaurant or your local Applebee's, of course, they only benefit from things like crop insurance or disaster relief. And that still can be a lot of money. Between 1995 and 2017, a total of $369.7 billion in crop insurance and disaster relief were paid out to someone.
Wow.
And so that's our lay of the land. Now, if you took a survey now of the U.S., you would find that there are 2.1 million U.S. farms. 97% of these farms are, I'm gonna say it this way, quote-unquote family-owned.
See, well, yeah.
Scare quote. They're family owned, but please don't think that's like a small 1 acre field with someone just growing carrots because they like to.
No, I mean you're talking about hundreds of acres. A lot of times, dozens would probably be common, but then thousands of acres is going to be also very, very common.
But that didn't just happen overnight. These are generationally held lands that are expanded, you know, and passed down, right?
Yeah. I mean, we still use phrases relating to that practice in office jobs across the planet. Say, don't sell the farm.
Right.
Or someone's going to buy the farm.
Or farm it out.
Or farm it out. There we go. Yes, exactly.
The farm is the one thing that can sustain us if everything goes bad.
I'm going to send you to the funny farm.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking of farm as an acronym, like free all real Americans. I don't know. I'm working live. This isn't always
going to. Free all real Americans.
America today feels like that book Animal Farm.
I think now you might just be naming things with farming.
Yeah, that's true.
but yes, yeah, they do play this vital role. We see it in language. We know why farms are important, of course. Everybody kind of likes eating. That's a trend we can agree on.
Mm-hmm.
But why are farm subsidies important? Because they get a tough run occasionally in this country and in others. People will say, well, you know, farm subsidies are symptoms of something called protectionism, but of course, they're also necessary.
Yeah.
On some level.
Yeah. Where are you going to get all the food that your country is going to eat, especially in the United States? Well, you can get it from a bunch of other places. You have it all shipped in if you want to, but that's a little dangerous relying, you know, depending on your percentage of relying on imported foods to feed the majority of the citizenry. So it is very important to have that kind of thing
in your backyard.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise you will be at the mercy of the private entity, or the nonprofit, or the other country that is feeding you.
Or just travel and logistics. I mean, you know, so many things can break down in a system like that. Look at what's going on with coronavirus now and how, you know, that's really affecting trade with other countries.
And shipping.
And shipping. Exactly.
Yeah. Sales of face masks are going through the roof, even though a lot of people have no idea how to use them.
Yeah.
Apparently it's largely, neg anybody or if it makes you feel better, but I think it's largely like almost like ineffective.
It's not going to work if people aren't already practicing basic hygiene.
Right.
Wash your hands. You guys know, everybody listening, you probably know the rule, but just to say it, if you're worried about contracting certain diseases or if you're in a place where you think there might be a lot of nasty bugs around, whenever you wash your hands, you just sing in your head or out loud, if you have a song in your heart, just sing the happy birthday song twice. That's how long you need to wash your hands to actually disinfect them with soap and water.
Yeah. Or, you know, memorize like an M1 song or, you know, something like that, and you'll be good to go.
Dead Prez.
Yeah.
Maybe Way of Life with Stickman.
Yeah. Just do – like if you do that, maybe most of the song, you're good.
So you're up early, Matt. Please write to us if you get that reference. Write to us if you get that reference. So the thing is, you guys are exactly right. Countries have to eat. And if we don't take proactive steps to ensure that we have some kind of food supply, then everyone will be left to the cruel whims of fate. The government has a job when it comes to food production to make sure, ideally, that regardless of what's going on with the economy, regardless of what kind of wars are happening domestically or abroad, people are able to eat. And that is why food production occupies a weird spot in the pantheon of domestic businesses. It's kind of like, you know, a lot of governments support or subsidize their aircraft industry because they also need planes. Ideally, you don't have to be buying those from another country. So food has to be in some way supported. At least that's the common wisdom so far here in 2020. But there are other reasons we need farm subsidies beyond just the brutal, realist geopolitics of it.
Yeah, and this is where you get into things like money and how much it costs. And we're going to talk about that right after a quick word from our sponsor.
We're back. So I'm going to be completely transparent here. I lived a long time. I have farmers in my family, but I lived a long time without knowing or even understanding the commodities trade involved. The commodities trade for farmers is essentially an open exchange where people agree on the price of a crop. Because we talked about crop prices going up or going down, but we never talked about how they're actually assigned.
Yeah, how does that number get there? It's kind of weird. So they trade on these things called futures. Now, this isn't too complicated. Think about it this way. Anytime you plant something in the ground, it takes a certain amount of time to then harvest a consumable product.
And so within that, you get like this almost like stock market of its own kind of where people are like placing bets on the success or like the way a certain crop will behave. And there's obviously conditions that feed into that, whether it's weather or, you know, pestilence or any kind of conditions that are out of people's control. So when you start trading on futures, you're kind of trading on the promise of a thing that doesn't exist yet. Like you know about the tulip bubble in the Netherlands where tulip bulbs were worth so much money and it created this like supply that exceeded demand and it just kind of tanked. But futures is interesting because you're right, Matt. Like they do it with whiskey too. You buy stock in whiskey barrels that take decades sometimes to age. It's a really interesting concept of futures. It is a little weird to wrap your head around, but it also is strangely straightforward. Ben, is there anything you want to clarify about that? We hit it.
Yeah. It's gambling.
Right.
Yeah.
It is gambling, but it's a necessary system because, you know, imagine you plant a crop at a time when you saw the crop selling for, I'm just making up numbers here, saw it selling for $5 a bushel. And there was nothing like a commodity exchange. You couldn't make an agreement that your crop would, when it was time to harvest, also sell for $5 a bushel. And without that, what happens if you put all in all this work and now it's only selling for 50 cents a bushel?
Mm.
You know, it's a gamble that people – you could compare it maybe to a utility bill. Some utility bills will give you the opportunity to pay your bill on what's called a variable rate. Right?
Yeah.
For a power bill per therm or something. Or you can get a fixed rate for 6 to 12 months, which may be a little higher than you would want, but is it gives you the advantage of consistency. So that's what people are looking for.
And you know, one of those ways really screws you out of money, and I still am not sure which way is the best or the worst. And I've done both in the course of my lifetime. I just want to put in here so we get to the kind of connected up to the next thing, just that concept of betting on what the crop is going to be like by the time we get around to harvest time. That concept that I'm going to lock in this price with a futures contract of how much a bushel is going to cost or a barrel or whatever it is going to cost.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that futures contract, I'm going to take out giant loans for all the stuff that it costs, for a ton of money that it costs to actually make this harvest.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of farmers rely on loans. You borrow in the spring, and that's when you plant your seeds, and then you pay your debt in the fall when you sell your harvest. And that also makes it feel, you know, like you're gambling. You're doing a little bit of roll the dice and YOLO, people could argue. But this also means that if you have a few years where, for one reason or another, something completely beyond your control, crops were bad or crops were good but prices were low, then you are one catastrophe away from possibly going under, you know, getting the farm, you know, foreclosed upon, or having to sell a bunch of equipment or something like that. And from the statistics we saw, many farms can't survive about 2 years of bad luck without going under or getting in serious trouble, because farms can't move. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You can't pull up your tent stakes, really.
I mean, shoot, most of us, I'm just going to put myself in this category, can't afford 2 months of bad luck in their current financial situation. Just putting that out there. So imagine in like being a big business like a farm with all of this based on loans that you have to take out every year. Yikes.
I get anxiety just thinking about it, man.
Yeah.
Whenever somebody asks me to predict specific numbers, it always feels like a trap. Why else would you ask someone to do that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, it's a whole different podcast, but this is one of those things and one of the reasons maybe at some point we should explore self-harm and farmers and, like, you know, suicides and things like that.
Mm-hmm. The pressure is just immense. I mean, to perform in so many things, like, again, that we were talking about that are out of your control, acts of God, you know, crazy weather patterns and storms, and this idea of, you know, climate change maybe or maybe not being a thing, sure seems like it's a bit of a thing that has a real impact on a lot of people's lives, especially
Agreed.
In that industry.
Agreed. And so we've painted a very broad picture of how this industry works. And it seems, like you said, Noel, it seems pretty easy to understand once you go through some nuts and bolts on it. But not so fast, because first it appears that the image of the small family farm that many people outside of farming communities think of is not as accurate as we might imagine. We know that it was true at some point, but now just to turn a profit, as you guys said earlier, you have to accrete more land. Volume, baby. Economy of scale. Capitalism, right? The only ideology that can take a t-shirt that says, you know, screw capitalism, and then sell them across the planet for $15 a pop. I mean, people get mad, but that's how the system works. The problem here is that when it comes to farm subsidies, ideologies aside, a strong body of critics argue that this system has a dark side that's more expensive than you think. Here's where it gets crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that this system, just like many systems, just isn't perfect. There is an absolute litany of problems. First, since not all crops are eligible for subsidies, like we said at the top of the show, countries can get into situations where there's a lack of diversification of crops. Farmers who really need subsidies might be forced to grow crops that are dictated by these programs, which affects variety or diversity of agricultural products in the market, which then ultimately defeats the purpose of lowering agricultural imports, because then products that aren't produced locally are going to have to be farmed out, as it were.
There we go.
Elsewhere.
Yeah. I mean, think about – okay, so think about that. We're the government, and we're saying, okay, we'll pay you to give you some – to give you a support net, right? A safety net, rather, a support network, a safety net while you are growing food for the nation. And we'll try to make sure that you can make some sort of living off it, but only if you grow the following things. And then someone's like, well, I grow tomatoes. Do you guys hate tomato? What's going to happen? How do I survive as the tomato guy? And then they naturally say, and you can't blame people, they say, well, forget tomatoes. I'm going to grow a different crop that is way less risky. That means eventually this domino effect occurs and no one's growing tomatoes, right? And then something happens where we need tomatoes and we think, we should have been nicer to those other countries.
Yeah, you should have come to me a year ago.
No, it's true. I mean, you really do have to – you have to chase those subsidies in the same way like film production is, you know, people – you go where the money is. You go where the best tax breaks are, and it's just not even a question. Like, sure, maybe I love blueberries. It's my favorite fruit. I've always wanted to be a blueberry farmer, but there just isn't that same money for blueberries as there is for corn.
Yep. And there's not a silver bullet solution for that. Another problem is that this leads to discrimination against some farmers, right? That's the thing. If you insist on growing a non-eligible crop, then you have a higher chance of failure. And if you play ball with the government and grow a subsidized crop, you have a higher chance of success. Somebody's putting their thumb on the scale, and people who are against government intervention, just in general, right? People who lean a little more libertarian would say this is not the correct way to address the system, that this becomes big government too quickly. And it is a very big bet that we're placing. The other problem, environmental damage. If you were a traditional farming outfit, then you rotate crops.
Yep.
You plant crop A one season, you plant crop B another, and they kind of interact with each other to feed the soil, to keep it from being worthless. Because eventually, if you grow the same thing, depending on the crop, then the soil will just not sustain it. It won't be as nutrient rich because all the other identical crops wanted the identical stuff in the dirt, and there's less and less of it to go around.
That makes sense. I never thought of it that way.
It's really interesting. I only took one very minor gardening class at a local place over here, but it was really – that was the big takeaway for me, was rotating crops and figuring out how you actually get your soil to be ready for a certain plant, mm-hmm. and then switching that out so then the nitrogen gets back in, or the levels of nitrogen and pH balance and everything gets correct. It's very – I mean, it's fascinating. I'd never thought about it before. I thought, oh, here's some dirt. Put some stuff in there and then it'll grow. Yay.
But you have to wait.
That's why there's agricultural science colleges. Thank goodness.
Thank goodness. And the other aspect here is, of course, this is related, but it's not a one-to-one thing, is the enormous use of pesticides, which were later proven to be quite deleterious to anything that wasn't a certain crop, as well as animals. Like people scoffed at us. I'm going to brag a little bit. People scoffed at us back in 2009 when we said there's solid proof that a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids are directly responsible for the collapse in domestic bee populations.
Yes, I recall.
And it turns out we were right. Well, the scientists who did the research were right.
And we just said it into microphones.
We just listened to them.
Hey, but you picked a winner, guys. Good job.
Well, this is true. So at this point, you might be saying, wait, how does this affect me? Matt, no, Mission Control, Ben, I'm not a farmer. I have nothing against them, but I'm not a farmer. What does this matter to me? Other than, you know, I'm paying my tax dollars, right? And I don't have a control of where they go.
And I do like rice cakes.
And I like rice cakes, you know. And I've always thought of myself as a blueberry farmer, a tomato guy.
That's right. My local Thai restaurant is like one of my favorite spots.
I can see that because now they finally give you the appropriate heat, right?
Yeah, and just really great rice.
This guy has a hard time convincing people in restaurants to give him the amount of heat or spicy he wants.
Yeah, Thai places will say, you want it Thai hot, and they look at you really serious, and I go, yes.
I mean it.
Can you make it hotter?
I'm a pro.
Nolan, I have seen that in action.
Don't question me. No, it's true. Matt is a spice monger.
Lord,
an absolute spice junkie. Spice lord. Yeah.
Yeah. Spice lord. So.
Traveling without moving.
So it affects you in another way, and it's very important. Let's walk through it. When people are paid to focus on certain crops, those crops end up being cheaper. And when they end up being cheaper, they become a more common part of your diet. It's just easier. And that is why grains overall make up 1/4 of the average American diet. Another 1/4 of it is made entirely of oil from corn, soybeans, and canola. Fruits and vegetables, if you're keeping score, are 10%, less than 10%. And more than 6% of these farm subsidies go to stuff that your old middle school or high school nutrition teacher would have called junk food. Corn syrup, high fructose corn syrup, which is in everything.
Isn't that the top part of the food pyramid?
Supposed to be, yeah. Fats, oils.
Right.
Yeah. It's supposed to be, and the food pyramid has its own problems, right? But if you are from the U.S. or if you've ever traveled here, I'm sure you've noticed when you read the ingredients of stuff that corn is in a lot of things. Yeah. Not even things you would expect, right?
Manufacturing products.
Mm-hmm. And part of that goes back to the subsidies. So you could build an argument then that the federal government – through its food subsidization is contributing to America's obesity problem. Because again, high fructose corn syrup is in everything. I'm sure our friends Lauren and Annie over on our sister podcast Savor have an episode about corn syrup. But it can be bad for you, at least when you're consuming it at the level that most people do. U.S. farm subsidies also block global trade. This is its own thing. We won't spend too much time on this. But U.S. farm subsidies have an effect beyond the domestic market. In fact, you can hear multiple voices in developing countries arguing against these subsidies in developed countries because – if you're a farmer in a wealthy country that can pay you a guaranteed price or even give you a safety net and if things go sideways, then it's much easier for you to sell stuff than it is if you're the same kind of farmer in a less developed country whose government does not give you subsidies. So one of the most well-known examples of how these policies can affect farms, even if they're outside of the country that has the subsidies, is the relationship between Haiti and the U.S. involving rice.
Mm.
So Haiti is a developing country. It had the capacity to produce rice. It does have the capacity, but at one time it was able to produce all the rice it needed for its people. However, now that is no longer the case. 60% of the food consumed in Haiti is imported. They lowered tariffs, and so they were flooded with rice that was cheaply produced in the United States and was able to outcompete rice farmers in Haiti because they didn't have those subsidies. They didn't have a helping hand from Uncle Sam.
Wow.
And this meant that the domestically produced rice was displaced. So this is a thing where removing that trade barrier led to a very real cost for the people of – or the farmers of Haiti. So the people of Haiti were able to get food at a lower cost, but the rice farmers had – you know, they got painted into a corner. according to Oxfam and the IMF, I want to correct myself here. I believe now, okay, Haiti is importing 60% of its food overall, but 80% of the rice is imported now, which is crazy because it would have been, if not for this trade stuff, it would have been entirely a self-sufficient country.
You know, this is a real issue here. And I would say a lot of the problems arise because of the next thing we're going to talk about. When the way we've been talking about this, it makes it feel like, okay, it's a farm, it's a family, it's a, whatever you want, whatever a family looks like to you, it's that, just living on a farm and producing a thing. Mm. But as we find, these subsidies are not necessarily for that type of farming situation.
And we'll get to that after a word from our sponsor. And we're back. There's another problem, and you can see it in the example that we just gave about Haiti and rice. And the trade deal stuff, that's a whole different bag of badgers. The point we're making is that these subsidies overall throughout the world, in whichever country they occur, they tend to help high-income business, not the poor rural farmers that so many people think of when they hear the word when they hear the term family farm. As a matter of fact, the majority of this money goes to huge agribusinesses, and the numbers are spooky.
So between 1995 and 2017, the top 10% of recipients got 77% of the $205.4 billion that was distributed. And that is according to the EWG Farm Subsidy Database. Then the top 1% received 26% of the payments, and that kind of averages out to around $1.7 million per company. 50 people on the Forbes 400 list of the wealthiest human beings in America received farm subsidies. On the other hand, 62% of U.S. farms did not get any. And you remember Raven, who wrote to us at the top of the show and clued us into this topic. We will let this savvy listener sum it up. We've got Riceland Foods Incorporated at $554 million. Producers Rice Mill Incorporated, $314 million. Farmers Rice Co-op, $146 million. Number four, only 48 million received, and it trickles down from there.
It's a pretty big discrepancy.
It's a big old dip, isn't it? So what's the deal?
Well, the one thing you'll notice is that it's all rice producers.
Well, sure.
Uh-huh.
Very uncreatively named corporations, if I might add.
And it's a precipitous dip from one rank to the next, from 554 all the way down to 314, and then number four, only 48 million. I say only 48 million.
Right.
I don't think any of us have been in a situation where we said, it's only 48 million. It's not like 50. We can still go to Dave and Buster's later. Sorry. It's my dream to be at a Dave and Buster's with an ungodly amount of money.
Wouldn't you rather have Dave and Buster's tickets?
I guess so. Yeah. Yeah. I would want to participate in their currency, right?
They won't take your money there, Dave and Buster's. Only tickets.
I don't know why casinos bother me, but I love Dave and Buster's. It's kind of the same thing, but for kids, right?
Well, it's really for drunk adults, kind of more than anything.
Okay. Well, I haven't been in a long time.
Oh, I thought you'd never been. I was about to be very sad for you. You talk about it so much.
Yeah, I love the idea of it, at least.
When are we going to go?
We should go. That's our show, folks.
You guys want to go to Chuck E. Cheese with me and my kid?
Yeah, because you have to have a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a playground at a public park, right?
Yes.
It's creepy if you don't have a kid there.
Not to divert too much from the topic at hand, but did you guys know, maybe you haven't mentioned this before, they have this crazy system where when you go in, you get an invisible ink stamp on your hand and on your kid's hand, and they have to match, and they like shine a light on you before you leave to make sure you're not like running off with someone else's kid.
Good.
Pretty clever.
I condone this system.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll go with you, Matt.
Yeah?
Yeah. Do they have skee ball?
They do.
Do they have laser tag?
No.
I'll still go, but I won't stay long.
They have this Yoshi's Haunted Mansion game that is pretty awesome.
I'm in, assuming this whole thing doesn't burn down before we get a chance to go. Raven, you also noted the possibility of another conspiracy. And we'll quote from your letter here. You said, the bigger payouts were substantially higher than all other years, and they happened at the same time, 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002. Now, remember, we had that statistic that you quoted at the top there, Noel. In 1999, the subsidies were huge. They were $22 billion. But, Raven says, I don't see a record of a natural disaster or anything that could warrant the need for so much assistance. Raven continues and says, for a company like Riceland Foods that boasts almost $1 million a year in revenue, why would they need so much in subsidies? And why are the top three also rice? Riceland Foods and producers Rice Mill are both also based in Stuttgart, Arkansas. That's a place with less than 9,000 people. And so this leads Raven to conclude, what, the U.S. just pays them to exist? Plus they get insurance, so if they lose money, they can file an insurance claim? You can't tell me, says Raven. There's no conspiracy here. So I have to ask you guys, you know, is it possible that this is corruption? Is this pork barrel politics? Is somebody pocketing these millions of dollars? I mean, these are corporations, so I'm sure that the executive suites are, you know, getting their vig in the form of bonuses or performance compensation or something.
I would say it just feels a bit odd because you know they need that money to stay in business. It does feel weird that the companies wouldn't attempt to, like, pivot to maybe something else that wouldn't require that level of, like, I think it was 55% of the profits coming from, or 55% of their income coming from government subsidies. It seems like you'd have to switch and start doing something else. Just knowing that if you end up losing those subsidies, depending on who's in office and the way, you know, the winds of change from whatever government becomes, you know, whatever.
As to which crops become priority, you mean?
As to whether or not those subsidies continue, because they may not, because there's a big debate now about. A lot of times it's portrayed as in one hand you have subsidizing crops and farms, in the other hand you have SNAP and, you know, helping those who are in need.
Right, like WIC.
Food stamps are just food assistance programs.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, and a lot of times it's not – those two things aren't necessarily connected, but maybe it's just they appear to be connected in people's minds. And lately they've been tied together in taking money away from food assistance and adding money to subsidizing farms.
The idea being that those two things are so inextricably intertwined that you're kind of putting money in the same place.
In a weird way?
Wouldn't you say that's somewhat disingenuous?
I think it's very disingenuous because what you could be doing is all of those over, you know, creating too much supply and all of these things being paid not to create food. Why would you just not have specialized processors like farmers and processors to make specialized foods that are then specifically for those programs that are just then free?
I see.
But then
you're saying
paid for with the subsidy itself.
Well, ultimately, the bill comes due.
You know? That's true.
Someone gets left holding the invoice at the end of the day. But it is a good question because governments also try to get in front of this, for lack of a better corporate term, by buying up those excess crops and saving them for a rainy day or saving them for people who need assistance. But also, you know, it is not disingenuous to argue that SNAP and agricultural subsidies are related, because if the government is paying for food assistance of some sort, then it wants the lowest price, right? And it's strange because you can see how there might be a conflict of interest there at some point. Like if you put too much money into subsidizing farms, maybe it affects the price of food that the government pays for under SNAP in a way that they didn't anticipate or in a way that they do not find favorable. So sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing here. And that's not saying that anybody's necessarily a bad actor. That's just saying that this is a complex system with a lot of moving parts, a lot of stakeholders, and a lot of people with goals that contradict one another. So of course they're going to butt heads. But one thing is for sure, Raven, there is a lot of money in play here, and money tends to make people, if not terrible, a little less worried about ethics in general. Related episode for anyone who hasn't heard it, check out the podcast that Matt Knoll and I did on whether wealth makes you a bad person.
Yeah.
The studies are fairly conclusive and terrifying.
Yikes.
True.
Like, you're literally more likely to take candy from children. Someone did that study and I think replicated it.
Money can't buy happiness, but it sure can make you an asshole.
There we go. There we go. I want that crocheted and hanging up somewhere, you know?
One of those little circle frames, yes. You know?
Yeah. I want to carry that as a placard around and replace all the live, laugh, love signs I see with that. I can't do that. You can't replace other people's signs. It's up to them, you know? If they want to live, they want to laugh. Wow, I sound like a monster.
Hey, I want to bring something up, monster. Not sure. No, I want to bring this up. There's something I was reading earlier today about finding ways to get more money out of these farm subsidies. And it was – and correct me if I'm wrong, Ben, Paul, Noel, or you listening out there. I believe the amount of money you can get in this subsidy for farming was $80,000 per individual. Then you could go into like a co-op or into a create a group or company then that has a group of individuals, and then each one of them could get $80,000, and then that co-op can get a much larger sum in subsidies from the government. Then you can use that for a larger farming operation, essentially. And I don't know exactly what the limits are for any of that stuff, but it does seem as though you could exploit the system in a couple of ways just by teaming up. Do we know if that's correct?
There are definitely loopholes that are in play. I mean, that's the only way that only 100,000 individuals could collect 70% of the money at play here.
So then I just wonder what we aren't able to really explore the full numbers here, but how that is affected when you, let's say you build those numbers up. Mm-hmm. And you have a large enough operation that you do get into the, you know, $500 million subsidy range. That's pretty astonishing. And I wonder at what point that $554 million is actually sustaining and making, like, generating real wealth for the individuals involved. As we were talking about, like, I wonder how wealthy actually some of the people running those large companies are.
Right, because you've heard the phrase land rich, cash poor.
Yeah.
There can be people – like through a variety of different financial instruments, you can appear to have much less or much more money than you actually possess. You know what I mean? Especially when you're leveraging loans, you're leveraging futures, speculation gets involved. It's true. There is a lot of money at play, and there are many opportunities to game the system. That is not the same thing as saying that people are thieving or doing that, you know, that they're purposely doing that. It's just saying the opportunity is there. We do know that the farm subsidy program, at least the modern version of it, has occupied a special place in the halls of Congress and in the halls of various presidential administrations. Like, you guys remember the auto industry bailout, right? Or the bank bailout. People were up in arms, torches, pitchforks, you know, both sides of Congress had some angry words to say, and it was hotly debated. But the USDA created the new farm subsidy program just like out of thin air.
Yeah, they did.
Congress didn't really have anything to say about it. And we know that if we look at the state of subsidies today, they're going to continue. In 2019, the federal government delivered the biggest aid package it had. It delivered in 14 years. You know, the price of farm subsidies has spiked. These subsidies aren't going to go away. They may wax and wane in terms of the total money paid out by the government and hence the taxpayer. And the question is, should they go away? Because we know that there's growing instability in the global climate, and we know that that means, even just that alone, means that further government intervention is probably in the cards. Even people who would otherwise say, you know, no big government whatsoever, even those people will sometimes make an exception and come out in defense of things like, you know, the military, right, or the agricultural industry, especially if they're involved in the farming industry and are otherwise solidly libertarian. They'll say this is different because everybody needs to eat. Now, what do you think about this, folks? What are farm subsidies? Are they an economic necessity? Are they an opportunity for a quagmire of large-scale, billion-dollar-level corruption?
Are they a fun combo?
Right.
Like a number two?
Is it a necessity in corruption with a side of fries and sour gum?
And what is it, mohair?
And mohair.
Mohair container.
Just sprinkled on top?
Yeah. You don't like a little hair on your burger?
No.
No. I feel like that's not a hot take.
I don't think so either.
What if we get so many emails from people who are like, I can't believe you guys eat unhairy burgers.
You ever got a hair stuck in your throat and you pull it out and it just doesn't stop?
No.
It's really long hair.
Like a gross stage magician?
Yeah, just like that.
Like the ring?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Never had that happen to you?
Nope.
Me either.
Oh, good. Okay, good. I was worried for a second. But we do want to hear from you because this is a very serious topic. There's a lot of money on the table, and one of the biggest points we have to make before we end the episode today is this. Obviously, this weird arrangement has a lot of imperfections. Obviously, there's plenty of room for conspiracy and corruption and later cover-ups, but that should not be taken in any way to be an allegation against all farmers. Farmers throughout American history and in the modern day are some of the hardest working individuals in this country, full stop.
There you go. That's exactly what I would say. Paul, do you want to give shout outs to any farmers out there that have been listening to the show? Paul says, I send you my admiration and love. He's giving me his phone number. Okay. He says he's going to retract that, but he does send his admiration.
But
to
we
you.
In the room here only get his contempt and icy stares.
but you know, he's a tough love producer. You got to respect the guy.
It's true.
So
definitely, it's all about the chase with Paul.
he is going to kill us. So as always, we want to thank you for tuning in. We want to hear from you. You can find us any number of ways because this concludes our episode, but not our show. Some of the best parts of our episodes are the parts that you generate in conversation with our fellow listeners online. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Instagram. We love to recommend our community page. Here's where it gets crazy.
If you don't want to do that, but you should, but if you don't want to, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave us a message. Tell us what you're thinking. We look forward to talking to you, or at least hearing from you, and then maybe you'll get a call back. Who knows? If you feel like this whole episode was just a giant tease to hear Paul's voice and you didn't get it, head on over to Movie Crush. You can find him. Search up his name, Paul Dekant. Search it on the internet if you want to. Track him down. Not like in a creepy or at least super creepy way.
You said what you said.
It sounded pretty threatening, dude.
Like, just do it in a standard creepy way. You know, waiting outside, staring up at his window in the rain. It's all good.
Holding up a giant jukebox playing In Your Eyes by Peter Gabriel.
Or, you know, whatever your choice of music. Just make it happen. I would say Casey Musgrove is probably a good call. It's a weird plug for that. I have no idea why I would say that.
Or if you have... if you have input here, and especially if you have personal experience with farm subsidies,
yes,
and you have seen, you know, allegations of corruption, or you have seen the system work beautifully, we want to hear from you. If you're one of those people and you say, I have something to say, I hate the internet, I remember your Facebook episode from a few years ago.
We do too.
We do too. And I, like many people, hate using phones, but I want to contact you somehow. Well, you are in luck, friends and neighbors. We have one more way to contact us. You can send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.